You don't ever really rise until you start talking. They're all waiting for that cue.
So today I'm going to be talking about some work I did last year with my excellent advisor and collaborator, Eric Weinberg at Columbia. And the question I'm going to be addressing is this. You're up here, and you want to be down here, where here and here are respectively the true and false factor of some scalar field, and the scalar field lives in sitter space. So you've got a metastable minimum up here, you've got a stable minimum, stabler minimum down here, and the question that I'm going to be addressing is twofold. How do you get from up here to down here, and how fast do you get from up there to down there? And I'm going to answer these questions in six parts, like this. Part one and two, I'm going to review what you know about decay and tunneling in familiar context. And then taking forward the morals of this story, and with this at the forefront of our mind, we're then going to address tunneling in the sitter space, as told to us originally and most influentially by Coleman and DeLucia. And as well as telling you about what Coleman and DeLucia told us about tunneling in the sitter space, I'm also going to mention what some people down the years have found somewhat puzzling about what Coleman and DeLucia told us about coming into this space. And then taking the morals of those puzzles in hand, I'm then going to tell you why you shouldn't be puzzled by tunneling into this space. Why, in fact, if you can understand tunneling of a single particle in quantum mechanics, tunneling of quantum fields into such a space should hold no further mystery. And finally, I'm going to come on and address this question. Should we think of tunneling into sitter space as being a predominantly quantum process, tunneling through a barrier, or should we think of this as being a predominantly thermal process of fluctuating up and over a barrier? That is the plan.
And the question marks
are? The question marks here?
Yeah.
We'll get on to the question marks. Okay. But the question marks have to do with the fact that some people found what Coleman and DeLucia have to say puzzling.
And you're going to address it.
Yes. So, starting at the beginning, the tunneling of a single particle at t equals zero in quantum mechanics. Classically, that ball that's sitting there isn't going to go anywhere, but quantum mechanically, you know that it can tunnel through the barrier. First thing to notice is that the place it tunnels through to is not the true vacuum down here. It's in fact an escape point that has the same energy as the place that you tunneled from. Quantum mechanical tunneling conserves energy. Two-step process. Step one, quantum mechanically tunnel through to the escape point. Step two, classically propagate from the escape point down to the true vacuum. You know what the rate for this is. It's given by e to the minus b. Well, it's given by something times e to the minus b, and today I'm not going to be too concerned by what that something is, because this b up here in the exponential is going to dominate the decay rate in the semi-classical.
Oh, so this is, you have to take that picture of the tunneling in the cloud. I mean, what you should really do is you should be looking for the classical path, which has the boundary condition that it has a fixed energy at one end and a fixed energy at the other end, right, rather than a position-to-position path.
Yes, you should be looking for a classical path. Well, you know that the escape point must have the same energy as the point you started with.
I guess what I'm resisting is that you're phrasing it as if I am, it's like an energy to position amplitude rather than an energy amplitude. And normally in WKB approximation for point particles, when you put the wave function with the path integral and you kind of do the integral over the endpoint, you would just end up just changing the boundary conditions of classical paths. So instead of talking about point of position, you go to, if you specify the energy in the state, you go to fixed energy, you specify the energy in something else, you go to fixed something else. And so if I'm asking just a tunnel out, it sounds like I should be asking the energy question rather than the energy position question. So,
well, so in this quantum mechanical case, at least in the semi-classical limit, those two questions are really the same. If I tell you what position is, and it appears at rest, that fixes the energy and vice versa. So at least in this case, and in the semi-classical limit, those two are the same.
So for particles, that's the way it works. And so for when you get to the field theory cases, is that going to be the distinction that I should be thinking carefully about? Or
I don't think so. I think that's not the distinction. We're just going to look at simply tunneling in barriers such as this, where your energy is given by the position of which you end up. If I can rephrase the question, you mean you should be unsure whether you're appearing at rest here or here moving with some velocity.
We just have to choose because really you've got a state on the right hand side and you're kind of living out the fact that it's got a phase, so there's no probability loss as you go from left to right.
Yeah.
But in field space, that step is kind of more complicated to do, and then I don't know if people actually think it's too very carefully.
Okay.
Well, if you have the particle, so the problem is really, there is a problem of what you choose for the initial state. But if we start from ground state, the metastable ground state, then the wave function is quite, say, sharply peaked.
Mm-hmm.
So, presumably.
And those are the usual words that you would say to make that connection. But in field theory, those get harder and harder to make. So the question is, since there's actually a right answer, and the right answer is really to go to fix the boundary conditions of the classical path. In the field theory case, and sometimes in field theory, that makes a difference. So that there's, back in the wormhole days, what people were actually calculating was not a field-to-field amplitude, they were implicitly calculating a field-to-momentum amplitude, and that made a difference as to whether you had saddle points or not. And I just want to kind of know whether or not you've sussed that.
Okay,
I suspect that
the array is just by convolution by the wave function. Yeah. Well, that's how you derive it, you devolve the wave function, then by saddle point, you do the integral, and the integral over the final state turns the boundary condition in the classical path into the one where you specify something else besides position.
Yes.
So that's why it's the right answer.
Right.
I think I agree with everything you said. However, all I'm doing is saying that in the semi-classical limit, at any rate, we can build this and effectively do a identify the energy states and the position states. But you're right, particularly if you wanted to talk about this prefect, you certainly can look at it.
So when push down, what you'll actually do is you'll have a field, you specify a field in the final state.
That's right. what the answer is from the WKB approximation for this tunneling rate. It's got 1 over h bar sitting out front telling you that this is a process that's non-perturbative in h bar. And then it's the integral from the false vacuum to the escape point of some function of the energy difference between where you are and where you started off. So you can shift this whole thing up and down, it doesn't make any difference. And the tunneling rate punishes you for tunneling through high barriers, and it punishes you for tunneling through wide barriers. And that's just the answer you write down in the WKB approximation. I remind you how you derive that result in the language of instantons, which will be a useful second language to discuss this process. And in the language of instantons, this tunneling rate is given by 2 over h bar times the difference in Euclidean action between the instanton and the false vacuum, in case you started off. The instanton is just that path through Euclidean time. Euclidean is precise time, and you look for a path through Euclidean time with the minimum Euclidean action that takes you from where you start out, the false vacuum, to where you want to be, the escape point. So the instanton is the path through Euclidean time that takes you from the false vacuum to the escape point with minimum Euclidean action. Whatever that minimum Euclidean action is, you take away from it the action of the false vacuum, and and that gives you the decay rate.
So both quantities are IR divergent and then somehow the difference as well.
So
I mean by the IR divergence, I thought you're at the you are at the t equals zero, so there's
Oh, I see. IR divergent in that sense. So yes. So yes. Sorry. Yes. Okay. In the T zero case. Yeah. This is the expression for Euclidean action. So if you want to solve for the minimum half, you just need to solve the Euler-Lagrange equations, and then plug back in and plug into that expression, and in that way you recover the familiar result. And you can draw a picture of this process. And the picture looks like this. The picture is a picture of the instanton path, and it's a path in Euclidean time that takes you from the false vacuum to the escape point at some Euclidean time that we conventionally denote by zero. And this part is just the solution to this equation, and that is everything that you need to know about particle tunneling, except for one more conventional thing, which is since x dot the Euclidean velocity is zero at this point, we're at liberty just to continue this solution up from t four equals zero up towards plus infinity, and if you do that, then the because you're at rest here, you'll just follow exactly the same path in reverse. And this full path, the doubled instanton, is called the bounce. Why would you want to do that? You'd want to do that for two reasons. The first reason is that you can then drop this factor of two here. The more important reason is that in a field theory case, doing this will make the symmetries of the problem more manageable. Here, there's nothing to be manifest because there are no symmetries to the problem. When you do that, you have the bounce that goes from the false vacuum as a brief excursion to the escape point and then returns at plus infinity to the false vacuum. That is particle tunneling at t equals zero. And if you can understand that, you should be able to understand everything about tunneling. Okay, next, many degrees of freedom. Many degrees of freedom tunneling is exactly the same as one degree of freedom tunneling. You can think of many degrees of freedom tunneling as having as being just a multi-dimensional particle tunneling in a multi-dimensional potential, where each direction corresponds to a different degree of freedom. But now you have slightly more freedom. You have the, once again, you're going to tunnel from the false vacuum where you start out to some escape point. But now you have the freedom to choose where that escape point is. In one dimension, the only thing you could choose, well, in the instanton approach, was solving your Euler-Lagrange equations to choose the optimal rate, x of tor, to get from the escape from the false vacuum to the escape point. Now, as well as choosing that rate, you also have two further choices. You can choose the optimal escape point. Different points here are going to be faster or slower to tunnel to. In the semi-classical limit, the rate is going to be tunneled by the fastest, is going to be dominated by the fastest escape point. And so we have the choice to choose which is the fastest escape point and concentrate on that one. We also, once you've chosen the escape point and the place that you're tunneling from, you then have a choice of what's the optimal path to get from one to the other. So that's one further choice you have. Other than that, those two choices you have, this process is exactly the same. The formula for the rate is given by exactly the same formula. It's just e to the minus b, where b is now the integral along the optimal tunneling path of this expression. Once again, you can express that in the language of instantons. B is the difference in Euclidean action between the bounce, the optimal escape escape path through Euclidean time, and the action he first thought of in the false vacuum, where the action is now given by the sum over the individual contributions from all the degrees of freedom. And so that's tunneling with many degrees of freedom. Once you've done tunneling with many degrees of freedom, you've in fact done tunneling with quantum field theory. Because quantum field theory you can just think of as the quantum mechanics of field configurations defined on spatial slices, free field configurations. The quantum mechanics of free field configurations is quantum field theory. In the lattice approach, this becomes the quantum mechanics of a degree of freedom sitting in every lattice point. So since we've done tunneling with many degrees of freedom, we can immediately just import that to do tunneling of quantum field theory. And that's what I'll do now. In the lattice approach, you should think of the action as being the sum over every lattice point of this expression, the kinetic term, the gradient term, and the potential term at every lattice point. But you can think of the, and indeed in lattice field theory you do think of, the gradient term as just being part of the potential term, insofar as it's just a function of the field values at neighboring lattice points. So if you think of this like this, of field theory like this, you can just do exactly the same thing you did before, where the potential is now U of phi of x, this potential defined not at each point in space, like V of phi, but on three field configurations. And you're going to tunnel in this three field configuration space by exactly the same method as you did before to get exactly the same answer. So in practical terms, we have V of phi here. This is our potential, telling you what the energy density is at each point as a function of the field value there. And we're going to do the same thing we did before, consider tunneling in this space with subtlety that we don't have homogeneous tunneling in field theory. The three field configurations don't tunnel homogeneously from the false vacuum to the true. Instead, you're going to bubble loop here. So once again, just as in the particle case, it's going to be a two-step process. You're going to start off with a homogeneous false vacuum everywhere. First step is then you're going to tunnel from the homogeneous false vacuum to a three-field configuration that with a bubble in it, with a bubble of true vacuum in it. So you're quantum mechanically going to tunnel from a three-field configuration where it's all false vacuum, so a three-field configuration where it's still mostly, and indeed asymptotically, false vacuum, but with a bubble of true vacuum in the middle, separated from the false vacuum by potentially a thin wall, though depending on the parameters of the potential, that wall may not always be so thick. And if you do that, then since quantum mechanical tunneling conserves energy, you know that this field configuration must have the same energy as the field configuration you started with, which means that the energy you have to give up in order to have this wall, this interpolating wall that goes over the top of the barrier and has gradient energy, must be precisely balanced by the energy that you get back by having the inside be true vacuum rather than false vacuum. And indeed, it's the balance between those two tendencies that's going to set the radius for that nucleated bubble. Step one, have your field configuration tunnel from the false vacuum to the false vacuum with a bubble of true vacuum in the middle. Step two, classically propagate, once you've appeared with this field configuration, the bubble of true vacuum is just going to grow. Indeed, it's going to grow approaching the speed of light. And as it grows, classically, it will convert the false vacuum to true. One thing to stress again is that you shouldn't think of the analog of V of X, the particle tunneling, the particle potential we were tunneling in, as being V of phi, a disembodied potential at every point. Instead, you should think of the analog as being U of phi of x, this potential defined on three field configurations that includes gradient terms on those three field configurations. And if you think of that, think of it in those terms, then in this U of phi of x potential, the field configuration is tunneling from the false vacuum field configuration to the bubble field configuration, and where the false vacuum field configuration and the bubble field configuration which you're tunneling have the same energy. Once again, you can draw a picture of that that looks like this. You start off with the field configuration given by this yellow line here, down at tau equals minus infinity. You then tunnel through the field configurations given by each of these horizontal slices in turn, the field configuration defined on those horizontal slices, until at tau equals zero, you reach this field configuration given by this blue line, or this blue point, which is a space with a bubble, a three field configuration with a momentarily stationary bubble that's big enough so that it will then expand, converting the false vacuum to true. So you tunnel through to this three field configuration, false vacuum with a bubble of true vacuum inside it, with a wall interpolating between the two of them. And so that is tunneling at t equals zero. Are there any questions about it?
So it's a trajectory of the boundary between the false and true vacuum before t equals zero, just the solution to the classical equation.
That's right. So this whole thing is the solution to the Euclideanized equations of motion. And each slice, each constant force slice corresponds to your tunneling path from the path you started off at, or equals minus infinity, which is the false vacuum, to the path you end up at. And then classically propagate away from this field configuration. So the rate, e to the minus b, once again, exactly the same as in the particle case. B is given by the difference in Euclidean action between the bounce, the optimal tunneling path from the false vacuum to the escape point, minus the Euclidean action of the false vacuum. I'll note for future use that this can be re-expressed as 1 over h bar times the integral of the Euclidean time, the difference in the energy of each field configuration in the bounce minus that of the false vacuum. And this plus and minus infinity here is the IR divergence to which you were referring. But since these become the same at the as four goes to infinity, it's a well-defined difference. So that's the rate. The initial conditions after tunneling, so the initial conditions that you get when you finish tunneling, that you then classically propagate from, are just given by the following description. Take the slice, the tau equals zero slice. Because of the symmetries of the problem, the field is stationary on that tau equals zero slice. So that slice is a slice defined on R3. It's a field configuration defined on an R3, a slice through there. And that field configuration just becomes the field configuration defined on this R3, a slice through Minkowski space. And then once you have a stationary field configuration given by whatever the field configuration is over here, and then you just classically propagate away, and classically this bubble then is going to expand and convert the false vacuum to true. Any questions?
Why would
someone
miss
the
angle? Why do you match it? Equals zero with telescope?
So what you call this tau, it's conventional, this is called tau equals zero.
Right. Sure.
The place you match is the place where the derivative is zero. The Euclidean temporal derivative is zero. So we just call that point tau equals zero, and that's the place you match at. In fact, if you were unsure where to match, you could convince yourself that if you had to match anywhere, this had to be the place. Because this is, in fact, the only place that has the same Lorentzian energy. This is the only slice that has the same Lorentzian energy as the false vacuum.
So the condition of no time derivative is like the condition that you have no velocity when you're sitting at the edge of the garden.
That's
which would be the criterion that you have the at that point that's the having interchange
original space. That's right. Yeah. There's no so that's tunneling at T equals zero, at zero temperature. Now let's do non-zero temperature tunneling. Classically, the ball didn't get out of a false vacuum. Quantum mechanically, you can tunnel across, conserving energy, there's some escape point over here. Thermally, you can fluctuate over the barrier without having to do any quantum mechanical tunneling at all. And in fact, in general, you're going to do a mixture of those two things. In general, what you're going to do is you're first going to thermally fluctuate up, because once again, a particle tunneling at non-zero temperature. You're first of all going to fluctuate up to some energy, a thermal fluctuation up to some energy E. And then once you're at that energy E, you're then going to quantum mechanically tunnel across to the escape point. And you can write down a rate for this process. The rate to fluctuate up to some energy E, and then once you're there, quantum mechanically tunnel out. It's just going to be given in this semi-classical limit by the product of the two terms to do it separately. So you first of all have this term here, which tells you the rate to thermally fluctuate up to have an energy E. It's just the standard Boltzmann suppression term, e to the minus beta, whatever the temperature, times the difference in energy between the place you're thermally fluctuating to and the place you started from. And then you have this second term, which is the quantum term, that tells you how quantum suppressed is the process to, once you're there, then quantum mechanically tunnel across to there. So in fact, now at non-zero temperature, particle tunneling is a three-step process. Step one, thermally fluctuate up, for which you pay this price. Step two, quantum mechanically tunnel across, and the quantum mechanical part, of course, conserves energy, for which you pay this price. Step three, classically propagate down from the escape point down towards the true vacuum. And these two terms are in opposition to one another. The thermal term wants you to start off with as low an energy as possible, because then you pay as little Boltzmann suppression as possible for having to thermally fluctuate up to there. The quantum mechanical term wants you to fluctuate up as far as possible before tunneling. It wants you to have as high as energy pre-tunneling as possible. Because then you have less far to tunnel across, and that bit that you do still have to tunnel across is proportionately lower. So these two terms are in opposition. And as h bar goes to zero, this term wins. And you end up tunneling, you end up thermally fluctuating all the way up to the top. As the temperature goes to zero, this term wins, and you end up quantum mechanically tunneling all the way across. At some intermediate temperature, there's in fact going to be some optimal rate, optimal energy with which to tunnel, which is itself going to be intermediate between the top of the barrier and the false vacuum. You can calculate what that optimal rate is just by differentiating this expression with respect to the energy at which you're going to tunnel. And when you do that, you differentiate this with respect to energy and set that equal to zero to get the optimal tunneling rate. To optimal tunneling energy at which to tunnel, the energy that will dominate the decay process. If you're looking here, you'll see a range of energies with which the particles appear, everything from the top up here or that. Even beyond, down to the false vacuum. But those energies will be dominated by the tunneling process with the largest rate, which will be given by this energy here, energy E here, which we calculate, and you can calculate just by differentiating, to be the following. That energy E, at which you have affect the optimal trade-off between thermal fluctuation and quantum tunneling, is precisely that energy E. such that the period of the bounce is equal to h bar beta, beta being 1 over the temperature. So that energy E at which you you affect this optimal trade-off, if you then calculate the energy of a bounce going from there to there, that bounce will have a period h bar beta. And so this is actually a familiar result, that h bar beta is the correct periodicity of a bounce at a non-zero temperature, and indeed at zero temperature. At zero temperature, that just recovers the infinite bounce, the R4 bounce. But this is a kind of a good way of looking at it, because it tells you why this is the optimal period. It's because it gives you the optimal trade-off between thermal fluctuation and quantum tunneling.
To the point that so the period now. Sorry. The period now. Now is finally has been. So start from the top.
That's right. So if you calculate, if you solve the Euclidean equations of motion, starting from here, you'll find that the field returns to itself, or the particle returns to itself in a finite Euclidean time. Starting here, you'll find it doesn't. As you approach the top there, that period goes to infinity. And the reason it goes to infinity, you may find it helpful to think of that this is an equivalent problem to the problem of particle mechanics in an inverse potential. And so in an inverse potential, a particle just starts at the top, remain there forever, and the period goes to infinity as you go up. And so once again, we can plot this process, and it looks like this. Here's the instanton that now doesn't have, this yellow line doesn't go all the way down to infinity. We now have a finite period for the dominant decay route, the instanton. It doesn't now go from the false vacuum to the true vacuum. It never went to the true vacuum, it just reaches the escape point. But it now doesn't go even from the false vacuum. It now starts off some way up the barrier, where it is thermally fluctuated to. It then goes from there across the escape point, and since we doubled it, it then goes back. So this yellow line tells you where you start off, where you thermally fluctuate, where you start off the quantum particle process, where you thermally fluctuate to this yellow line. You then quantum mechanically tunnel what from the yellow line to the blue line, with this giving you your path along the way. And then we double it to go back again. And now you can make a categorization of how much of a thermal process was it and how much of a quantum process was it. So we're going to think of of particles that appear exactly with the energy of a false vacuum as having been a purely quantum tunneling process. There was no thermal assistance. You didn't thermally jump up. It was purely a quantum mechanical tunneling through the barrier. At the top, you can think of that as being a purely thermal process. If the board appears with an energy equal to the potential at the top of the barrier, that was a purely thermal process. There was no quantum mechanical tunneling across. It was all thermally fluctuating up. For intermediate energies, you can make intermediate classifications. You're going to tend to get pure thermal behavior, or more thermal behavior, or higher temperatures, of course, but also for flatter barriers. Because for flatter barriers, quantum mechanically, you pay for the barrier not only being high, but also being wide. So we're trying to tunnel across a wide barrier. That exacts a further price, quantum mechanically. But thermally, it's the width of the barrier doesn't matter. In a thermal ensemble, the only thing that makes any difference is the difference in energy between where you're trying to thermally fluctuate to and where you thermally fluctuated from. So the consequence is that for both higher T and for fatter barriers, you tend to have more thermal behavior. For lower T, lower temperature, and thinner barriers, you tend to get more quantum type behavior. You can tell exactly the same story for field theory. Yes.
So before we go to the field theory, does the particle appear thermal with the right after it?
Any individual particle can't be thermal. We're going to imagine that you have some process. This is one way to think of it. Imagine you've just got a collection of particles here.
Right.
There's some Bunsen burner or something keeping them at a certain temperature T here.
Yes.
And I'm going to sit on this side and just look at each individual particle coming through. So now each individual particle, I don't see lots, I just see one of them at a time, which I'm going to give an energy to.
But the collection looks thermal.
All the energies together are going to, well, that's a subtler question. They're going to have an energy that's grouped around the dominant energy place, but they're also going to have a spread of energies. But it's pretty hard to say whether that's a thermal distribution or not. It's not really a thermal distribution because the energy levels available on this side are now different from the energy levels available over there. So really, the energy, semi-classical limit at any rate, the energy is just going to be a delta function around whatever energy the dominant energy.
So the point is that, in the long run, so the particles after they come off probably should be thermal, but it may be a two-step process. So they first come out that they don't appear thermal, and then they re-thermalize.
Sure.
So is it a two-step process or a one-step process that they
I think it's going to be I think it's probably now, if you want to include that step as well, we're going to have a four-step process now.
Right. I'm kind of squeezing your three steps into
single step.
Yes.
So step one, thermally fluctuate. Step, which doesn't conserve energy, or at any rate, for an individual particle doesn't conserve energy. It conserves energy if you include the heat bar. Step two, quantum mechanically tunnel, does conserve energy. Step three, classically roll down here, which does conserve energy. Step four, all these particles that are now accumulating down here are going to thermalize. But I think that is going to be a fourth separate step. Do you want to include that step?
You can test for the number of particles as functions of energy, and if you're at the very top, it must be true that you just see the thermal distribution truncated, so you're just getting a tail.
That's right.
But so then as you come down, you're going to start convolving that with the probability of tunneling through.
Yes.
That would be distorted from thermal.
Yes, it must be distorted because nothing, for example, and if it was truly a thermal ensemble built around this state, you expect the dominant thing there to be, having.
No, but you don't have to think about the equilibrium at all. You just think of it as being a well of emitting particles and you just look at them as a function of energy.
Yeah. Yes. And I mean, that's definitely not going to be a thermal
particle.
I mean, for example, that whatever the dominant, there's going to be more particles for this energy. If this is the dominant process, there's going to be more particles with this energy than with that energy. Mm-hmm. And having more particles with more energy isn't a thermal. Mm-hmm. Okay, and you can draw the picture again. Once again, for U of phi of x, now because we're in the field theory case, first of all, you thermally fluctuate up to some field configuration given by this yellow slice here. Then you quantum mechanically tunnel from that yellow slice to this blue-yellow slice to a field configuration on this blue slice, and here's the tunneling path. Here. You each point in Euclidean time, the field configuration on that three slice gives you the three field configuration of the tunneling path.
So in that bottom yellow line, the pink area is kind of odd, right? So the bottom yellow line, that would mean You, as you go into the bubble, you're producing a false vacuum, which is at the yellow spot on the field.
That's right, but it's not going to be a homogeneous false vacuum. The reason that this diagram looks kind of funny is because the thin wall limit is actually a pretty bad limit to think about if you want to do this. So that having to draw it like this with a thin wall bounce, because that's the only thing I know how to draw, actually obscures exactly what's going on. But the spirit is right, that first of all, you tunnel to some field configuration which is not equal to the false vacuum, which is equal to something other than the false vacuum, perhaps with a little bit of true vacuum already in the center there. And then once you're there, you quantum mechanically tunnel to some escape.
But it's not a true vacuum in the sense that it's not the, if I thought, supposing it really was a thin wall description, so that the pink region was a constant field,
yeah,
then the value of that field is not the value at the minimum on the outside, it's the value rather than...
No. So,
is that right?
If we really learn the thin wall limit, this really would be,
that
field configuration, it's the field configuration here, is the field configuration with the blue dot, but that's an inhomogeneous field configuration, and includes at different points both fields that have the value of false vacuum and fields that have the value of true vacuum and everything in between. And once again, we can make the same categorization. We can say that things that happen down here, tunneling processes happen down here, quantum tunneling. Things that happen up here are thermal fluctuations, pure thermal, and then all the intermediate categorizations. And similarly, differently now we can also do it by eye. Here you can draw what the instanton looks like for various different values of the field. And things that are purely thermal, because there's no quantum mechanical tunneling going on, tend to look homogeneous in Euclidean time. Things that are purely quantum look inhomogeneous in time, in Euclidean time, as you know they must, because you know that the field configuration in which you start off in must be the false vacuum, since it's purely quantum. So there must be inhomogeneity in tall in order to get the field configuration that you're going to then escape from. The rate and the initial conditions are both known. The rate is given by e to the minus b, where b is the integral from minus h bar beta over 2 to h bar beta over 2 of the difference in energy between the energy of the bounce at every free configuration tall that you go through minus the energy of the false vacuum. Similarly, the initial conditions of tunneling you also know. We know that the yellow field configuration corresponds to the place you thermally fluctuate to before you then quantum mechanically tunnel. And this blue field configuration here, the field configuration on that blue R3 slice, gives you the field configuration on this R3 slice through Minkowski space, you then classically propagate from and classically evolve from.
Can I ask a question that's been just asked about? What the field values are. So when we look at the instant solution or the bound solution, so the value of the field don't go to the true value. But when you really look at the real space, the picture, your field inside bubble does take the value of the true value.
That's right.
So how do you do the analytic distribution to go from somewhere not in the true vacuum to the true vacuum?
So I haven't really used the words analytic continuation so far.
I thought I would go from say the sphere to the hyperboloid. That is precisely the process that
that's right.
We're doing.
You don't need to do analytic continuation in what I've said so far. I mean, there will be a step of analytic continuation later on, but at least in the standard story. But basically, there's nothing to it. You just take the field configuration on that slide, and that operation on this slice. It is also independently true that you can calculate the field configuration. I mean, there are two ways to calculate what the field configuration is at this point here. One way is to just take this initial equations of motion and just evolve it using the Lorentzian equations of motion. And the other way is to analytically continue the solution you have. Analytically continuing the solution you have it's never clear why that would be a better thing to do than just solving the Lorentzian equations of motion. It would often be a more confusing thing.
This is to do with the first issue, that if you set up a problem where you actually specify, say, an energy or something rather than a position, then that what becomes complex in the saddle point approximation depends on what you don't fix. It doesn't have to be the usual thing that it's just time.
Yeah, I guess so. That is true. But I have sidestepped some of those difficulties by moving to the semi-classical domain.
I think that the problem only really comes when you go to graph. That's what surface we choose to match on you.
I just know a specific example where in the wormhole days where that was the puzzle, that there existed in the Minkowski signature in Minkowski and Euclidean signature that they differed in whether or not these solutions existed. And the resolution was that if you actually were careful about what you meant by the tunneling was being done at fixed momentum rather than a fixed position, and then fixing the momentum as being a real specified number then changed where the saddle point lived. And so then the solutions you're looking for were complex where you weren't expecting to be complex. But I think you're right that it gives you the same answer at the end of the day if you do it carefully.
That's a slightly different.
I think it's related in the sense it's how you do the analytic continuation.
Well, that's so even if I don't want to go, I mean, so since you brought up the issue of how to calculate the field, say it's a bubble word, so it's a wave function inside a bubble. When you say you try to do it just by time evolving.
Yes.
So how do you choose the initial condition?
So the initial conditions on this slice are given to you by this description. Take whatever the field configuration on this slice through here is. Whatever the field configuration is through there. And remember that's a static field configuration.
Right.
So that's just you not find it off. That becomes the field configuration on this slice here.
Across you.
And that's the closure term.
Right. I think I understand how to do it. I understand how to do it that classically, but I suppose I just want to calculate what is the wave function of the field. It is not really a wave function given that the field inside the bubble is actually entangled with the field outside the bubble. So I really should talk about the density matrix of the field inside the bubble. How do you do that?
That's right. So that's a harder question to answer. I am just straining myself to the semi-classical limit, where everything I can just consider, I consider it to be a wave function to be well described and well peaked around dominant classical field corporations. So that's what I'm looking at. But certainly, you could do that calculation. Certainly, in the Minkowski place, that would be a reasonably straightforward, but harder calculation to do, in which you could just write down the Hamiltonian at every point, and you know what the Hamiltonian is. So at least in principle, you could evolve whatever density matrix you start with and work out what density matrix is at a later time. So I mean, your question does have an answer. I'm just short-circuiting that question by going to this limit in which everything's sort of
clean. There is, since I'm starting here, why is just that? I mean, really, when you think about the bubble creation, it's really sort of like not really a classical process, not really a quantum process. It is not a classical process in the sense that right at the pink line there, so the field really has a jump at the quantum mechanical level. It is not a purely quantum process in the sense that you do have to choose a background in the future where you have a classical bubble.
It's a semi-classical process. Approach, you kind of ignore all the quantum fluctuations, except every now and again you say, well, I wasn't quite right to ignore entirely the quantum fluctuations, so we're going to have a classical process just kind of jump to take account of that. So really, I mean, neither classical mechanics nor quantum mechanics has jumped. Everything's perfectly smooth in both in both cases. It's only in the semi-classical where you include quantum effects only by having classical evolution and then occasionally a quantum jump to take account of the fact that you should really have been doing quantum evolution. And so it's in that limit that you have this. And you're right, but it's distinctive to this limit that that there seems to be some jumps in the process, some non-local jumps that don't appear even in the classical or quantum description.
Right. I mean, I guess we can talk about this later, but I think I mean it would be quite an interesting question just to
I think in the point particle case, if you had done the energy, that's related to the skin as a matter condition issue. If you'd done the initial energy to some point x, which is not the turning point, and you just asked for do the path integral semi-classically for that, then what you would have found is the wave function for that energy eigenstate at that position, which you would then convolve with whatever your final state wave function was to turn it into whatever else you really wanted to calculate for probability. So there's a very well posed, and then what happens is that the wave function becomes a WKB wave function, which is a
sounds very reasonable. And then you have to somehow classically see off the bubble wall, and then fabricate that into kind of how does that, say, even particles or something like that.
I don't know if anyone's ever done that in the field theory side, but it's on the point particle side that you can carry it right through.
I was talking about the field theory side.
Yeah.
So talking about the bubble.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree that.
Okay, so we've done parts one and part two. Now part three, tunneling into safe space, as told to us by Coleman and Lucia around the time of my birth. Coleman and Lucia included gravity. They thought about the back reaction of the field on the metric. They didn't just look in fixed and constant space. And there are really two effects of including gravity. One effect is that 5x now needs to be calculated on a curved background, possibly with horizons. In our case, indeed, we'll be considering the safe space that definitely has horizons. The second effect is that space-time is dynamical. It now changes not only in reaction to the energy density of the false back, but it changes in reaction to the energy density of banks. And what I'm going to do now is try and isolate this first effect. That means I'm going to consider only a fixed background decision space. And the advantage of doing this is that most of the peculiar effects associated with curved space time already appear if you just isolate this effect. And this regime is a much simpler regime in which to do calculations, which is why we're going to isolate. And so one way you can self-consistently impose that you are in this regime is by restricting yourself to consider only those potentials for which the true vacuum has a much higher energy, much larger energy than the difference in potential between the two vacuum. And if you restrict yourself to considering only those potentials, then you're guaranteed that the back reaction is going to be small and your space will not significantly deviate from the same space. So this is the class of potentials that we're now going to look at. So we have a fixed background safe space. The energy density of the false vacuum is like a cosmological constant. Since it's a positive cosmological constant in the cases we're going to consider, that just gives you de Sitter space-time, exponentially expanding space-time, which is both our past, if you believe in inflation, and our future, if you believe in lambda CDM, or the lambda part of CDM. We can put some metrics, some coordinates on these on the de Sitter space. One set of coordinates is these, the familiar flat foliation of the Sitter space, in which you're exponentially expanding or exponentially contracting, depending on how you put on the coordinates. Those actually aren't going to be a very useful set of coordinates for us to put on the Sitter space. And so, in fact, there's going to be two other sets of coordinates which are going to be more useful. The first more useful set is going to be these coordinates, global the Sitter space. Rather than foliating the Sitter space with flat spatial sections, they foliate the Sitter space with And in these coordinates, it's clear why people say that you should think of the Cartesian space as being a hyperboloid space of one greater dimension. They make the hyperbolic structure clear. Each of these constant t slices of the Cartesian space, if you slice through there, you get a free sphere. Also called global Cartesian space because they cover the whole manifold. One more fact about Cartesian space that you should be familiar with: you have exponential expansion. That expansion can run the speed of light. Eventually, two things that get far enough away can't see each other. In fact, they only have a finite time to observe one another before they go over each other's center horizon. They're uncertain about its energy. If you calculate it precisely, this turns out that there's a temperature associated with such a space that is proportional both to the expansion rate, telling you the faster you're expanding, the higher temperature you see, and to H bar, telling you this is a quantum process associated with the uncertainty principle. That's the Cartesian space, and that's what we're going to be calculating our tunneling on. It was first studied by Coleman and Galusha, and they argue for what the prescription should be for tunneling in Cartesian space by analogy with flat space. They didn't, in fact, provide any sort of derivation. They just argued by analogy. They said, well, I know what to do in flat space time. I know that if I want to calculate the tunneling rate on Minkowski space, R3-1, I should just perform an analytic continuation on R3-1, and the instanton that governs tunneling on R3-1 lives on R4. In curved space-time, therefore, they said, if I want to calculate the tunneling rate for an instanton that lives on this space, on the sitter space, I should just analytically continue the time coordinate, and if you do that, if you plug in I-tor every place you see t, you get this expression, the metric of a four-sphere. So they said the instanton that governs tunneling in Minkowski space lives in R4. The instanton that governs tunneling on a hyperboloid in the sitter space lives on an S4. And once again, for the rate, they argued by analogy. For the rate, they said, in flat space-time, the rate is just given by e to the minus b, where b is the difference in Euclidean action between the bounce and the false vacuum. So it should be exactly the same in curved space-time with two differences. First of all, we need to add the R term, the Einstein-Hilbert term, to the action. But actually, this term isn't going to matter for our purposes, because it's going to cancel. Since we're considering the limit in which that reaction is small, that term is going to be the same for the bounce and for the false vacuum. And so, in fact, it's going to cancel between the two of them, since it doesn't depend on the field. The other difference is this root g factor. You secretly had root g in here before, but it was 1. Now root g needs to be calculated on a 4-sphere rather than R4. And we're going to have to remember to include it. But with those two modifications, the Coleman-Galusha prescription for the tunneling rate is exactly the same as the flat space prescription. They also gave, by analogy, a prescription for the initial conditions after tunneling. And this I've indicated with 6 question marks to denote uncertainty, unsureness, uneasiness with this prescription. And here's what it was. They say, in flat space time, I now know how to get the prescription for the initial conditions after tunneling. In flat space time, you just go to this R4, take the field configuration on this R3 through the center, on that Euclidean temporal slice, this R3 Euclidean temporal slice, through the center of that bounce. Whatever the field configuration is on there, that becomes the field configuration in Minkowski space, from which I then classically propagate. So, by analogy, in curved space-time, I should just take whatever the field configuration is on this equator, on this, it's a 3-sphere, this is the whole thing is a 4-sphere, the equator is a 3-sphere. I should take whatever the field configuration is on the equator of that 4-sphere, and whatever the field configuration is on that 3-sphere, becomes the field configuration on this three sphere. This three sphere here being the equator of the hyperbola. That was the description they gave. So they gave a rate tick and an initial condition after tunneling question mark that reduces correctly to the Minkowski result as gravity goes to zero, but no derivation.
What happens if you argue by analogy with different coordinates? Does it make sense to you?
Maybe I'll defer that question to later. So that's it. I told you about Minkowski space at zero and non-zero temperature, and I told you what Coleman and Lucia had to say about tunneling in the cis space, both with a rate that seemed reasonable and in initial conditions that I questioned and will question more in the next section, in which I'll discuss a thermal approach to tunneling in the cis space.
Okay. So can I ask a really question? So I mean, now that I'm confused by something, so even if I do it in the flat space time, I mean, if I stay in the force vacuum, I suppose it's still in a Lorentz invariant state. So I can always try to change frame. So a bubble that starts at rest in one frame is now the same as will travel with some speed. So it seems somehow the process that you have writing seems to be not the Lorentz invariant. I choose the frame and then I always say that the bubble should start a stationary in the frame that I choose. So why is that?
Exactly how Lorentz invariants is a subtle question. I'll do it this way. But you start in the city space, or Minkowski has 10 symmetries. In the city space, those symmetries are say, yes, so 4-1 symmetries. And the nucleation of the bubble breaks four of those symmetries. It breaks the four symmetries associated with shifting the position of the nucleation. So you now have just six symmetries left, which is SO3-1. And those six symmetries, you now have a hyperboloid that has a nucleation point. And that nucleation point breaks this four symmetries. But the prescription we gave said, you don't have this full hyperboloid. Actually, you choose some slice through here,
right.
Some spatial slice. And you kind of ignore that stuff, and you just take that stuff to being real. And so that actually breaks further down to SO2-1 symmetry. Generally three symmetries, just the rotation. And so that looks weird because these symmetries are gone, but at late times you certainly recover these symmetries. Everything looks the same. The only thing that's different is where you choose to put this spatial slice in. And I've never seen a full analysis of this question, but I think the answer is going to turn out to be that really this further breaking, this breaking associated with the spatial slice is just going to be a artifact of the semi-classical limit. And actually, if you try and set up an experiment to decide whether you mutate it along this slice or that slice, these different boosting from one slice to the other, if you try and set up an experiment that determines which of those was the true slice on which you mutated, you're not in fact, and the uncertainty principle can prevent you from deciding which of those
is right. I mean, in the case of the distance space, I mean, there are strong arguments saying that the global distance space really is not stable. So one really have to say compactify it. I mean, one has to regularize it in some way in the past. And that regularization presumably would break symmetry. And one way to regularize it is precisely just say go to the flat slicing and then compact it on something else. And that probably would do the job.
It's true that that does in and of itself break the symmetry. But it's hard to see how that symmetry breaking is mediated up to this point, whether the bubble is mediated.
I mean, can we just go back to say, a simpler situation where I have flat and constant space there? I mean, even there, where things seem to be sort of one. How do I recover? How do I recover the framework? How do I recover the rented symmetry?
So, I mean, this hyperboloid does have symmetries. This hyperboloid has set symmetries. It's got the full Lorentz symmetry. So, just as much in Minkowski space as in the system space. This hyperboloid has all six Lorentz symmetries. But it's when you cut off a bit of the hyperboloid at the bottom, it's how you choose to cut that off that breaks those symmetries. I don't think that breaking of the symmetries. But the same is true in Minkowski space.
I think I have a very nice question, which is that suppose I forget space. I just work in the Minkowski space, and I say that I choose my frame, and then I do the calculation that you did, and I see the bubble will appear with zero speed. It will just stay there, and then well, if I look at that process in a different frame, I will see the bubble will just going that way. And
so
that is not a
free. Yeah, that's not actually true. So you're asking if you're even saying is this hyperboloid right? And the answer is that this hyperboloid is right. That a different frame doesn't see the bubble as initially moving in one direction. Because as well as because the bubble has size, if you do a Lorentz boost, what you call the edge of the bubble is different.
Well, there is still a problem there. In one description, the bubble first appear at an equal time slice. In another description, one side of the bubble, appear first.
I guess maybe we could let's talk about this somewhat off, but that is the question about which of these slices we're looking at and which appears on. And I'm saying that you shouldn't take seriously that part of the semi-classic approximation as to choosing which of those slices it really appears on.
I mean, you probably should, in the sense that if you think back to the kind of the quantum mechanical example, what you're calculating is the wave functional. And that shouldn't be invariant, it should be carrying a representation of the Lorentz group. And so that is when you actually calculate some transition amplitude, that has to be. And you're not that, so you'd have to take this thing and fold it with whatever the final state is for your transition before you saw something.
So I guess I think the whole wave function is going to be the thing that's going to be invariant.
Why should it be invariant? It should carry a representation.
So, I mean, if you presume that you start off with a Lorentz invariant.
But the thing is, you're looking, asking for in the position representation, and in the position, so that field configuration is changing because that's literally how you slice it. And so you're representing the state in a basis which is explicitly changing under the future target.
That's true. I guess what I'm saying is, if you try to set up an experiment to determine which of those positions it started off in, you probably find that in order to set, I mean, this is a very rare process, and there's lots of quantum fluctuations. In order to set up an experiment, you probably find yourself stopping back just by coupling enough degrees of freedom in this, because you need to couple the bottom degrees of freedom and measure which of these two possibilities is right. And by the time you couple that number of degrees of freedom to the field there, you've probably radically altered the rate of decay at in that field.
You may or may not, but I think what I would say is that you're saying words which correspond to I take a final state and I convolve it with this wave function you pick me, and I get some physical answer and I ask the question of that answer. And it may not be, and more or less the statement is that the conclusions to that final answer are not being well drawn just by looking at the wave function, which is only half.
The initial stage,
so because you're talking, you're saying you can't just stop at setup with a tunnel that you need to set for some early time.
No, I don't mean that. I mean that even in the case of flash space time, if I look really far away from the bubble, I would see the bubble is precisely the future like cone of the point where the bubble first appeared. And so the future like cone is really, it's the future like cone. It is a frame. It is a frame independent concept. It is just a like cone of the point. That's why. But at a very early time when the bubble first appeared, that seems to be something that is something that really depends on the frame that you choose. But for the longer time period, so the whole for the large commitment, it indeed appears to be bringing.
Okay, good. Can I move on? I do think this is an interesting question, but not this interesting question. Turning into cis space. First of all, why do I put the question marks when I was describing the prescription for tunneling, for getting the initial conditions after tunneling? Why do I put the question marks there? And really, the two answers that go under some names up here. One answer, well, the basic problem is that this blue line, this three sphere, through the equator of the sitter space, corresponds on a conformal diagram. You can think of it as this blue line. It's the equator here through the sitter space. It involves the region not only inside my static patch, which is this chemistry sphere here, or this front chemistry sphere here. It also tells me about the field configuration out here on the back chemistry sphere. This kind of three sphere here, or this kind of three sphere here, which is outside my horizon. And this is worrying for two reasons. First of all, it seems pretty unlikely that we're actually living global set of space. We live in something that perhaps locally looks like set of space, or during inflation, we look like something that locally, within our horizon, looked like a patch of set of space. It seems very unlikely that we're living global space, something with truly the global structure of this space. And yet, the convolution description, through making reference to degrees of freedom outside the horizon, does it require us to believe in those degrees of freedom outside the horizon? Does it require us to be in global space in order to believe its result? If so, it's a pretty useless result, since we don't live in global space. Furthermore, not only do we seem required to know about what's going on outside our horizon before we can use common fiducia, it then seems to tell us about what's going on outside the horizon. And that seems to be contrary to what we think we know about horizon complementarity, how you shouldn't be able to discover what's going on outside your horizon. You should be able to discover what's going on at this green static patch here, or the field configuration through the part of the free field configuration that lives in that green static patch here. But this region beyond your horizon, you shouldn't be able to find out about that. And yet convolution seems to be telling you what that is. Second, I guess, point I'll make is that we already appear to be seeing some thermal behavior in the convolution bounds. Since you're solving these equations on a four sphere, a finite four sphere, and this is perhaps an instance in which you should forget about the thermal limit and remember that these are in fact smooth configurations that don't reach quite the false vacuum or quite the true vacuum. Not only do you never reach the true vacuum at the center of the house, it gets close to the true vacuum, and then the thermal limit gets exponentially close to the true vacuum. But away from the thermal limit, and even in the thermal limit, it never quite reaches the true vacuum. And similarly, the closest the field value ever gets to the false vacuum is at this antipodal point sitting out here. And out here, the field value never reaches the field value of the false vacuum either, because you're solving these smooth equations on a four sphere. It never reaches the false vacuum. It never reaches the field value of the true vacuum. And yet, we were meant to be thinking that we were doing tunneling from the false vacuum out. How can we be doing tunneling from the false vacuum when it never reaches the false vacuum? This problem is particularly sharp for the Hawking MOSFETs. As I continuously alter the parameters of the petrol, I need to keep resolving the equations on this foursquare. And I can resolve these equations on this foursquare such that by changing the parameters of the potential, such that this and this both move up. The closest it ever gets to the false vacuum gets further and further away from the false vacuum. The closest it ever gets to the true vacuum gets further and further away from the true vacuum. Until eventually I can reach this Hawking MOSFET, which is then enough in more bounds, in which the whole of the foursquare is covered by a homogeneous field configuration sitting at the top of the barrier. And really there, it's not a, if you try just to think of this directly, it's very confusing what's going on. It's never anywhere near the false vacuum, and yet it's meant to mediate tunneling from the false vacuum to the true vacuum. What are we to make of that?
So the fact that the yellow class and the blue class, they are not at the same level is because of the curvature of the sphere?
It's actually not to do.
Because?
It knows not to do with the curvature of the sphere. Even in flat space, they wouldn't be at the same level. The reason that the yellow cross and the blue cross are there is because this is not the U of phi of x potential that you're tunneling in. You tunnel in the U of phi of x, the potential determined on field configurations. But these aren't field configuration energies. These are just some sort of disembodied field value sitting here again.
So in the case of that space, so the yellow point, the yellow cross is in the false vacuum, the blue cross is in the vacuum.
In the which case?
In the flat space case.
In the flat space case.
The crosses are in the...
In the flat space case, the yellow spot is in the false vacuum. The blue spot may or may not be in the true vacuum, depending on how close you are.
So don't you think in that case there is such an interpretational issue because you are now trying to emphasize because the cross is not in true vacuum, which seems not to trouble. But even in the flat space case, you say it is not in true vacuum.
Well, except that we know how to interpret flat space case, which is you shouldn't be considering the field value, the field value to point in the center of the bounce. You shouldn't instead be considering the field on a free slice that goes to the center of the bounce. And you should be considering the U of phi of x energy of that, not the potential of that. For example, in this case, it means that the tunneling rate is entirely independent of whether the field does this over here or does something completely different over here. Because since the as long as it reaches the same false vacuum energy. Because since the field nowhere on this foursquare is equal to any of the field values over here, this instanton is going to be exactly the same independently of whether the field does this or does that. But of course, this isn't all that puzzling, given what you know about thermal tunneling. This seems to be crying out for a thermal interpretation. We should just think of the fact that you're never at the false vacuum as being, you shouldn't expect to be at the false vacuum because the sitter space is a temperature and you are thermally fluctuating up before quantum mechanically tunneling across in a manner I'll make precise in a moment. And the Hawking MOS seems very clear what the interpretation should be. We should interpret that as a case of all thermally fluctuating up and no quantum mechanical tunneling across. And I'll try and make that precise now. Inspired by both the concerns about horizon complementarity and seeing hints of the thermal behavior in the convolution description, I'll now ask a question and then answer. The question I'm going to ask is this. Suppose we explicitly restricted ourselves to a single horizon property. explicitly restricted ourselves to considering the field configuration in the causal diamond. And suppose we treated that field configuration as a thermal system, and we set the temperature of that thermal system as the de Sitter temperature. So suppose we treat a single horizon volume as a thermal system at de Sitter temperature. If we do that, what tunneling rate and tunneling prescription do we then derive? And I'll now answer that question. If we want to explicitly restrict ourselves to a single horizon volume, a useful set of coordinates to use are these ones. These are the third and final set of coordinates on the system space I'm going to talk about today. These are useful because they, well, first of all, they go to time-like Hilling vector. That's where they're called static system coordinates. And secondly, they only cover the static patch. They only cover this green shaded area. They only cover the region inside the horizon. So if you're trying to explicitly restrict yourself to degrees of freedom inside the horizon, these are good ones to consider. That means, in fact, you can see straight away that the constant t slices at constant t in this coordinates are going to be Hemming 3 spheres. It can be described by this metric, which is the metric of a Hemming 3 sphere. Constant t slices, such as this one marked in blue, just go up to the horizon and no further. The horizon of r equals zero, the sitter horizon of something sitting at r equals zero here, is just given by r equals lambda, which is where the this coordinate system ends. So now let's do it. We have this metric. We're going to consider a scalar field living in this space. We can write down an action for a scalar field sitting in this space. It's given by this expression. If you can write down an action, you can write down an energy functional. So this is an energy functional that takes a free field configuration living on this space and tells you and gives you an energy. One thing to notice about this is these factors of root A here, these redshift factors. And those should be interpreted as saying that you don't care very much, if you live in the sitter space, about things that happen a long way away from you. You don't care, as far as your energy accounting goes, about things that happen near the horizon. Because even if there's a lot of what looks locally like a lot of energy near the horizon, by the time they've sent that energy to you in the form of photons or anything else they want to send it to you in the form of, by the time they've sent that energy to you, it's been redshifted, and you get very little of that energy back. So this is the energy functional for this space. This root A, you should think of as accounting for the fact that you don't really care about stuff going on near the horizon. So we've got an energy functional. Now we can kind of forget about the fact that it came from this space-time, and just run our standard analysis using this energy functional. The rate for tunneling is going to be given by e to the minus b. If we were doing classical tunneling at non-finite temperature, you'd know exactly what the answer should be. It should be beta times the energy difference between the top of the barrier and the energy of the full stack. But we don't live in a classical universe, we live in a quantum universe. So we need to split that delta function, if you will, and calculate this quantity. The integral from minus h bar beta over 2 to h bar beta over 2 of the energy of the bounce minus the energy of the false value. And that's it. That is the answer to our question. What do you get the rate to be if you treat a single horizon volume as a thermal system at a sitter temperature and calculate the rate? And now all we need to do is calculate this, is plug in this expression for the energy functional, the energy of a free slice in there, and plug in this expression for the temperature of the sitter space in there, and we'll have answered our questions. So let's do that. And that's what the answer is. And if that's 80% of the answer, and that's it. That's the answer to our question. Now let's see how the answer to that question compares to the Coleman-Deluge prescription. the answer that the common illusion got. To affect that comparison, it's going to be most useful to put the following coordinates on a force scale. If we put these coordinates on a force scale, the comparison can be keenest. Common illusion said you could calculate, I haven't mentioned a force scale anywhere in any of this discussion. Common illusion saying you should calculate the tunneling rate on a force scale. The instant tunnel is on a force scale. Let's put these coordinates on a force scale. Coordinates we get just by inducing from putting the force scale in Euclidean five-dimensional space and inducing coordinates in this manner. And then you find that this is a coordinate system that lives on the force scale. And let's calculate the Kalman-Bouchard tunneling description in that system. This says B CDL gives you the Kalman-Bouchard tunneling rate, and it's going to be given by this expression, just using the Kalman-Bouchard tunneling rate in this space. And if you can compare this tunneling rate to this tunneling rate, you'll in fact see that they're the same. So the answer to the question I asked, what is the tunneling rate what tunneling rate do you get by just treating a single horizon volume as a static patch at a certain temperature? The answer is, in fact, the rate is the same answer that you get from Kalman illusion. But we can do better than that, because now you can ask not just about the rate, by treating the degree of freedom in a single horizon volume as a thermal system at a certain temperature, you can recover the Kalman-Bouchard rate. But there's an additional advantage of doing this, which is that even though you are unsure how to interpret the Kalman-Bouchard bounds, you know precisely how to interpret thermal tunneling. The thermal tunneling, you know what the description is. You know that this yellow line corresponds to the field configuration in thermally fluctuating. Is step one, the field configuration can thermally fluctuate two. These black lines represent step two. Each field configuration on each of these lines corresponds to the tunneling path from the yellow line to the blue line, which is the field configuration with which you classically appear and then classically propagate away from. But since we know how to interpret this and we've rewrite the Kalman-Bouchard description within this method, this tells us how to interpret the Kalman-Bouchard description. And the answer is this. The answer is that what blue line is in this description just becomes constant tall surfaces, become meridians, not full free spheres. They become penny free spheres. In fact, they become the prime meridian going through here, and the yellow line becomes the international date line around the back of this three sphere. So this tells you that you should continue to interpret this three-field configuration here on this hemi-three sphere, the hemi-three sphere that lives inside the horizon. That is correct to interpret that as being a field configuration that you get after tunneling inside the horizon. This yellow line here, however, needn't be anything to do with field configuration outside the horizon after tunneling. Instead, you can just think of it as being the field configuration that you thermally fluctuated to before then quantum mechanically tunneling to this blue line. And in fact, the tunneling path is just given by all the meridians going round from the international date line to the prime meridian as you go around. All of the field configurations on those hemi-three spheres give you the tunneling path, the three field configurations that you tunnel along. So one more time. To get the field configuration inside the horizon, which is in fact all the field configuration you'll ever see. Observationally, it agrees with Kalman-Bouchard. You should take the field configuration on this hemi-free sphere here. To get the field configuration, this field configuration on this back hemi-free sphere here needn't have anything to do with the field configuration out back here. Instead, you should think of it as being where you thermally fluctuate to before then quantum mechanically coming here. This depth description here agrees with Kalman-Bouchard inside the horizon. no information required of or provided about what's going on outside of Horizon. So finally, and I realize I'm running late, I'll answer this question. Is the city space decay a predominantly quantum process of tunneling through the barrier, or is it a predominantly thermal process of fluctuating over the barrier? Point number one, this is a slightly odd question, because the thermal nature of the city space is quantum origin. There's an H-bar sitting here. The thermal nature of the city space is driven by the certainty principle acting on the expansion. So quantum or thermal, quantum is that. But nevertheless, you can continue to make a distinction just by treating the thermal nature of the city space as a thermal system of unknown origin, forgetting about quantum origin, and we can still make a clean separation between those parts of the tunneling, those parts of the decay that are due to the thermal fluctuations, and those parts that are then due to quantum tunneling. I remind you what this distinction was going to look like. We said that things that appear up here, we're going to call pure thermal. Those tend to be homogeneous in tall. Things that appear down here, we're going to call pure quantum. Those are inhomogeneous in tall, and you have interpolating possibilities. But now we can use this to answer the question, first to confirm what people have long said, which is that you should think of the Hawking Moss as a thermal process, a purely thermal process. And indeed, that's exactly what we find. If you every field configuration along the tunneling path has exactly the same energy. It's perfectly homogeneous in tall. It just sits here at the top of the barrier. It sits here in the top of the barrier, not only at the top of the barrier in B, also at the top of the barrier in U. I guess I should say that the other way around. But it sits at the top of the barrier in both potentials. This truly is a pure thermal process. What about convolution analysis? Now it actually becomes a somewhat more subtle question, somewhat more interesting question, or a more interesting answer, which is that the same bubble can be observed by different observers from different perspectives. If you're near the bubble, you're going to think that the bubble is in the center of the universe. If you're far from the bubble, you can observe that bubble as it nucleates, appearing near your horizon. And in fact, whether it's a quantum or a thermal process that led to the nucleation of that bubble, it's going to become an observer-dependent question. We're going to find that observers who are near where the bubble nucleates are going to see the nucleation of that bubble as being a predominantly quantum process of time. Observers who are far from where the bubble nucleates, but whom the bubble nucleates near their horizon, are going to see this process as predominantly thermal process of quantum fluctuation. We can unwrap these using a Cayley projection, is what this is called. And you see, indeed, that if you're sitting here at the center of this space, bubbles that nucleate out near your horizon look more homogeneous than before. Bubbles that nucleate near you at r equals zero look more inhomogeneous than before. So immediately, just visually, it looks like bubbles that nucleate near the horizon are going to be more thermal, and those that nucleate near you are going to be more quantum. And indeed, you can calculate and confirm that that is the case by calculating the potential that this bounce is tunneling through by taking the field configuration at each slice as you go around, plotting that potential as it goes out there, as it tunnels through, and you find that those that nucleate near you emerge with lower energy than those that nucleate near the horizon. They tunnel through more, and they appear with lower energy. So the answer to the question, should I think of convolution tunneling as being a quantum process tunneling through, or a thermal process fluctuating over, is in fact a for a wide class of bounces, that becomes an observer-dependent question. So that's it. Any questions?
case of the Hawking loss, we were able to see that those theories are continuous. Should I interpret that Hawking loss transition happens only in half of the global emission space inside horizon, or the global, or it is global transition?
That's right. So the former. Hawking loss is in many ways the fact that most exhibit peculiar properties of precision space. And indeed, Hawking loss themselves, in what they say, and convolution by implication from what they say, both interpreted that bounce as being a bounce that happens throughout the entirety of global space, everywhere at once, both inside and outside of Horizon. But that's an extremely huge statement, because the whole of the system space is a very large place. And to believe that somehow this is a process that happens not just within our horizon, but then stretches out every other horizon patch throughout the entire universe and causes it to stay there, that seems improbable.
It will must change the geometry of the realized experience.
Okay. Okay. So, working on most of that.
So there is no transition that can happen.
Well, any transition can happen, but
yeah, very rare.
I mean, and indeed, it might be the case. I mean, if you set yourself up in that Hawking wave function, it's conceivable that what the convolution says about what's going on outside the horizon is actually true. If you start off with a very particular wave function, in fact, you know that some wave function, what convolution says of the whole universe, what convolution says about what's going on outside the horizon must be true. But it needn't be true. All you require is that when you trace over those degrees of freedom that are outside the horizon, you end up with a thermal system on your sample patch. That's the only thing you require in order to recover the convolution. You are not required to believe anything about what's going on outside the horizon.
So, I guess the real physical question is that how to calculate correctly for those transitions that happens in a region with a size bigger than the horizon.
So, if you knew the wave function of the whole universe before you started, not just the, I mean, there's no way to calculate what's going on outside your horizon unless you already know stuff what's going on. See, the Cauchy surface extends out there. But if you already knew what's going on outside the horizon, then that is a calculation you can do. But if you only knew about what's going on inside the horizon, you should never expect to be able to calculate what's going on inside the horizon.
Is there any application to modularized generalization?
I'm not sure what impact what I just said. Since it gives you the same description inside the horizon, yes. So, but it's true. If this prediction is a different rate from that predicted by convolution, it would certainly have an impact on that question of whether you successfully stabilized your moduli such that they're stable for longer than the age of the universe. Since this predicts the same rate, it's not going to have an impact on the question. Sorry.
Depending on the mechanism, and of course, if you have a large vacuum, you could use your poly.
Yes. So
it is totally different.
It's certainly true that you better, if you want to calculate the lifetime of some AKLC like something, you better use the full decision space, curve space time calculation. But the way most people would do that is they go and look at the convolution result and then do that calculation. And nothing I've said is going to make that spend wrong, because I find the same rate of convolution. In fact, I just said I was reinterpreting convolution, giving some new shine on the interpretation of convolution, rather than discovering a competing process.
So we we've asked a lot of questions, so then we should continue asking questions. So why don't we just let other people have a chance to ask questions? So can we thank them? And then continue to ask questions.